Well, this is very exciting. It's like being at the cinema, isn't it, really? The lights go down, the excitement builds, possibly. My name's Gordon Lynch. I lecture in practical theology at Birmingham University, and I'm here to talk today about embracing a Generation X spirituality. It's really good to be here at Greenbelt to talk about this. It's been a long time since I've been to Greenbelt, and actually seeing Greenbelt and flush toilets in the same place is still something of a bit of a shock to me, which I'm gradually adjusting to. One of the delights of doing a session like this is discovering about a month before you do it what you promised to do several months before when you weren't really thinking about it. And in my infinite wisdom, what I've sort of promised to do in this session is more or less to cover the whole content of a book that I've just published called After Religion, Generation X and the Search for Meaning. Now, sort of doing this in half an hour or so is going to be a bit tricky, really, so we are going to be at home to Mr. Superficiality this afternoon, so do sort of bear with me on that. But really what I'm going to do is give you some edited highlights, if you like, from the book, things that might sort of stimulate, interest, amuse, or just downright annoy you, really, just to kind of get some ideas going. And I think, certainly for me, one of the most interesting parts of the session is going to be, hopefully, time at the end where we can have some open discussion about some of the issues that we're looking at. Like a lot of the sessions that I do, this is going to be a session of three halves, really. After a quick introduction bit, I'm going to talk a little bit about what I think the characteristics of a Generation X search for meaning are, then talk a little bit about the role of popular culture in that search, and then a little bit about mysticism as well. So that's covering quite a lot of ground quite quickly. But let's start with some... if this is in focus, which it's not. Okay, can you vaguely see that? No. Okay. I'll read it out. This is some facts based on the UK Church Attendance Survey. So this isn't some kind of radical secularist document. This is actually a regular church attendance survey that's done every decade, sponsored by the Christian churches in the UK. These are three key points emerging from that survey, which the last survey results, which were published just about a year ago, go up to 1998, but they show quite a dramatic decline in church attendance. Basically, in the period between 1989 to 1998, around 1 million people stopped going to church in the UK. Church attendance dropped by about 1 million. Now, this is quite remarkable, given that the 1990s were meant to be the decade of evangelism, and possibly actually having a decade of encouraging people not to leave the church might have been a bit more of a better target for the churches, looking at these statistics. But not only has there been quite significant decline in terms of church attendance over the past decade, it looks as if church decline, at least to a certain degree, is now built into the system, that church demographics, the demographics of the church population, are such that people aged 65 and above, there's now a higher percentage of those in the church population than people coming into the church as children. Now, to put it bluntly, the number of people who now leave the church through death now exceeds the number of people coming into the church as children. So there seems to be some kind of, at least for the short-term future, foreseeable numerical decline there as well. The real doomsday scenario that came out of the UK Church Attendance Survey, and this is probably the worst case scenario, which might not actually turn out to be the case at all, is that church attendance has declined very rapidly over the past 10 to 20 years. And if it continues to accelerate at the same rate, then by the year 2016, probably by the time Rowan Williams retires, only around 1% of the British population would be attending church on a regular basis, which is quite a startling statistic. I think most commentators think that's probably not actually going to be the case, that we'll probably end up with the figure bottoming out about 5%. But I mean, the basic point to take in terms of an introduction is that we're in a really incredible time of change for the church, that the church is clearly becoming a minority institution in terms of British culture, and a certain degree more of numerical decline is likely. But that's very much the context that we're looking at. Now, in terms of the work that I've been doing at Birmingham University, what I'm really interested in is to try and understand what's actually going on in terms of contemporary spirituality in this country in the face of this kind of numerical decline. Because if we think that people do have some kind of spiritual dimension to their lives, then it's clear that there may be an awful lot that's going on in terms of spirituality in Britain that's actually outside the boundaries of the church, given the relatively small numbers of people who actually have contact with the church. So really my work's been about trying to understand or make sense of some of the trends of what's going on here. And the way in which I've done that with the particular book that's just come out is to make use of a Canadian writer called Douglas Coupland. Just a bit of arm aerobic exercise for you now. How many people have actually heard of Douglas Coupland before you came to this session? Actually, that's a healthy number. That reflects Greenbelt, I think. How many people had heard of Generation X before you came to this session? That's very green butter. When I normally do that, it's like two or three people out of 100, and I think to myself what a complete anorak I've been for the past few years studying something that no one's actually heard of. But I think this is probably representative of the sort of green belt population that these terms are more popular for you, or more well known to you. For reasons that I'm not really going to explore today, I think there's been a very interesting growth in literature on Generation X religion, where the basic claim is that there's this group, Generation X, who were born between the early 1960s to late 1970s, and that this group of people has a certain peer personality, a certain set of attitudes that influence the way in which they interact with religion. And there's been a growing literature on that. Books like Virtual Faith by Tom Bowdoin or Florian Miller's book on Gen X religion are probably the leading texts on that at the moment. Now, those books assume that there is this certain generation, a distinctive generation called Generation X, who've got a particular take on the world, which is different to other generational groups. For reasons that I won't go into today, I think that's actually possibly a false assumption, that actually there's a lot more in common between younger adults and their attitudes towards the search for meaning and older adults as well. Certainly large-scale American surveys of the baby boomer generation, the older generation, show much of the same themes that come up in terms of Generation X religion as well. So what I've been trying to do with my work is to look particularly at the work of Douglas Coupland, who I think has been a really astute social commentator over the past 10 years since he published his first novel, Generation X, in 1991, and to try and look at some of the significance of the themes in his work. This is actually a lavish multimedia presentation today, so it's not only OHPs, but video clips as well, which for me usually ends up in chaos, really, but fortunately someone else is doing the video today, so hopefully that will work better than for me normally. In terms of Generation X search for meaning, I think looking at the work of Douglas Coupland, what Coupland was trying to say with his work was that there are certain attitudes around in society, not connected necessarily to people being a certain age, but certain attitudes that a group of people have towards the search for meaning. One of the first points that comes out of Coupland's work on this is a kind of recognition of the importance of a search for meaning in life. For those of you who've read his novel Girlfriend in a Coma, you'll know that kind of speech towards the end about the importance of the characters in the novel engaging in some kind of search for meaning in life, asking grand questions about life, about what's actually involved in life. So within Coupland's work, there's a recognition that the search for meaning is actually very, very important. I'll just read you a short extract from his book, Life After God, where his narrator says, "Now here is my secret. I tell it to you with an openness of heart that I doubt I shall ever achieve again. So I pray that you're in a quiet room as you hear these words. My secret is that I need God, that I'm sick and can no longer make it alone. I need God to help me give because I no longer seem to be capable of giving, to help me to be kind as I no longer seem capable of kindness, to help me love as I seem to be beyond being able to love." So the idea of a search for meaning being important in life, having some kind of connection with transcendence or meaning, is clearly present in Coupland's writing. Now, at first glance, for some people in the church, that might seem to be a tremendously exciting opportunity. But then we come to the second point in terms of the Generation X attitude towards the search for meaning, in which there's a basic skepticism towards the ability of mainstream traditional institutions to provide that truth. And there's a basic skepticism towards what could be described as pre-packaged truth, sets of ideas that are generated by churches, political parties, corporate organisations, which are meant to produce some kind of catch-all explanation of what life's about. I'll read you another short extract from Life After God, which is a bit of a balance to the first one. And the narrator at this point is driving through the desert, listening to the radio. And he says, the radio stations talked about Jesus and salvation, and I found it was pretty hard listening because these religious types are always so whacked out and extreme. I think they take things too literally and miss too many points because of this literalism. This has always been the basic flaw with religion, or so I'd been taught, and so I realised I'd come to believe. So at least I knew one thing for sure that I believed in. The radio stations all seemed to be talking non-stop about Jesus, and it seemed to be this crazy orgy of projection, with everyone projecting onto Jesus the antidotes to the things that had gone wrong in their own lives. He is love, he is forgiveness, he is compassion, he is a wise career decision, he is a child who loves me. I was forever cut off from the experience of these people. I did not deny that the existence of Jesus was real to these people. It was merely that I was cut off from it in a way that was never connectable. So part of the Generation X search for meaning in Koopman's work is a sense that the search for meaning is a tremendously important part of life. But along with that desperate urge for meaning is a basic sense of being cut off from traditional sources of meaning, that these don't actually speak to a person's heart. They don't actually give them any kind of spiritual life or spiritual inspiration at all. And this ties into the third part that I think emerges from Koopman's work, is that the kind of meaning that's important for a Generation X search for meaning is a search for meaning that feels personally authentic, that connects with a person's deep inner experience, that connects with who they feel they are as a person. So rather than accepting kind of pre-packaged truths from above, from the preacher or from the government or from wherever, the Generation X search for meaning is about an exploration in which what becomes key is what is it authentic in terms of my experience, what speaks meaningfully to my experience. And I think those kinds of attitude of a search for meaning but a struggle with pre-packaged truth and a desire for personal authenticity in meaning is quite a significant trend in terms of contemporary spirituality. And I think we can see this both in terms of movements within the church, such as some branches of alternative worship and the post-evangelical Christian identity, but also as a sort of move beyond the church as well, a more general spiritual trend. Some academics have called this is the bit of theological jargon today, because I think with a talk it's always good to get like one bit of theological jargon from it, isn't it, that you can take away. And today's bit of theological jargon is detraditionalisation. Yes. So you can go out today and you can say to people, nasty bit of detraditionalisation you've got there. Have you seen a doctor? That kind of thing. But detraditionalisation is when people begin to disconnect themselves from traditional sources of meaning and begin to base their judgments on what's meaningful on their own inner experience. The self becomes a key way in terms of judging what's meaningful or not. And this seems to be the characteristic of the Generation X search for meaning. So if that's a basic kind of trend in terms of the search for meaning in contemporary culture, what are some of the resources that might actually be helping people with that? And I want to look quickly at two today. One's popular culture and the other is mysticism. And for are people familiar with Tom Bodine's book Virtual Faith? Have people come across that before? Yeah, one or two people. One of the claims that Tom Bodine was making in that is that as traditional sources of religious meaning begin to lose their significance for people in Western culture, popular culture begins to step in and fill the gap for people. It's almost as if popular culture becomes the new kind of religious texts with which people make sense of their lives, make sense of their experience. Now, this is where we move into a lavish multimedia bit. And if we have the first video clip, this is a bit from the film The Matrix.
Let me give you one piece of advice. Be honest. He knows more than you can imagine.
At last. Welcome to you. As you no doubt have guessed, I am Morpheus.
It's an honor to meet you.
No. The honor is mine. Please, come, sit. I imagine that right now you're feeling a bit like Alice. Tumbling down the rabbit hole,
You could say that.
I can see it in your eyes. You have the look of a man who accepts what he sees because he is expecting to wake up. Ironically, this is not far from the truth. Do you believe in fate, Neo?
No.
Why not?
Because I don't like the idea that I'm not in control of my life.
I know exactly what you mean. Let me tell you why you're here. You're here because you know something. What you know you can't explain, but you feel it. You felt it your entire life, that there's something wrong with the world. You don't know what it is, but it's there, like a splinter in your mind, driving you mad. It is this feeling that has brought you to me. Do you know what I'm talking about?
The Matrix.
Do you want to know what it is? The Matrix is everywhere. It is all around us. Even now, in this very room. You can see it when you look out your window or when you turn on your television. You can feel it when you go to work, when you go to church, when you pay your taxes. It is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth.
What truth?
That you are a slave, Neo. Like everyone else, you were born into bondage, born into a prison that you cannot smell or taste or touch. A prison for your mind. Unfortunately, no one can be told what the Matrix is. You have to see it for yourself. This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill, the story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes. Remember, all I'm offering is the truth, nothing more.
Stop that there.
Hey, Park.
I love that bit where he turns around and the sort of lightning flashes behind him. I'd like to do that for tutorials at college, really, but I can never really time it quite right. Dramatic effect, isn't it? That clip from The Matrix illustrated very clearly how The Matrix is very much a film concerned with issues of truth and meaning. What's the nature of the reality about life? If you haven't seen the film already, I'll just spoil it for you by explaining that Neo discovers shortly afterwards that the reality he thought he was living in is in fact a computer-generated simulation, and he learns to engage in a new reality in the future, which involves resistance against forces that are trying to imprison humanity. Now, there's a clear exploration there of issues of truth and meaning and salvation, what it means to live well, what kind of forces oppress and diminish us, and how we can resist those. So in a way, this seems to be quite a good example of Tom Bodoin's thesis that popular culture becomes a set of religious texts for us. I think one of the things just very quickly to say today is that the picture is quite complex, though, because the way in which people use those religious texts of popular culture can be very varied. Here's a couple of reviews of that film off the internet, both from Christian writers. One writes, "On first hearing about the film, one might think it carried Christian overtones, but the core message is pure New Age philosophy. Like Star Wars, Star Trek, and many other sci-fi, spy-fi films, spiritual fiction films, that is, this one is a powerfully dangerous vehicle used to evangelize our culture with Eastern religious beliefs. The central theme teaches that the world we see around us is not real, it is an illusion, and that salvation comes through realizing and knowing about this illusion. Once someone realizes this supposed truth, then they are free to exercise miraculous, godlike powers and overcome the hidden authorities that have been controlling their lives. These beliefs are identical to the New Age Gnostic philosophies I once followed before submitting to Jesus Christ. This insidious message originated with Lucifer and was seductively fed to Eve in the Garden of Eden. You should become like gods. As technology continues to improve and produce exciting special effects movies like The Matrix, Lucifer's ability to con the world will increase exponentially. Please protect your teens and warn your friends about these subtle insidious messages which are so toxic to their souls." Now, at the other end of the spectrum comes The Matrix as Messiah movie, which has a rather different view. And the writer of this website comments, later, he goes through a whole series of parallels in which the character of Neo reflects the life of Jesus. And he writes, later, Neo is killed by the authorities, the agents, and instead of 3 days, in less than 3 minutes, he's resurrected. We know that showing the passing of 3 actual days in this situation would have been impossible. That is true, or it had been a very long film, wouldn't it, really? We wouldn't have stayed till the end. The prevalent screen placement of 303, on the door, should alert the sensitivities of any New Testament savvy audience member who's aware of the numerical significance of the number 3 in the Gospels. This symbolic visual clue is all the film needs to alert the audience members to the significance of this momentary death. Now, what force brought Neo back from the dead? Love. The instrument of that love was Trinity, and not necessarily the person as much as what the name signifies in Christianity. With that in mind, let's look at the resurrection scene at the end of the film. Neo's brought back to life, if you've not seen the film. The Trinity leans over Neo and kisses him, the proverbial kiss of life or breath of life, and Neo awakens. And the first words Neo hears are in the form of a command from the Trinity, "Now get up." Can't you imagine God breathing life back into Jesus? And the first words Jesus hears are God's, "Now get up." Now, we've got slightly different views there of the film, haven't we? Which suggests that this whole idea of popular culture as a set of religious texts is quite a complex one, that the way in which people consume or make use of popular culture can actually be very different depending on their existing beliefs and commitments in the world. And I think one of the big agendas for theology in the future is to take seriously the idea that popular culture may be functioning as a new way of exploring issues of meaning, but to actually look at how people are doing that in everyday life, rather than just doing very abstract theological analyses of this. Now, the final point I just wanted to look at, as well as popular culture, is the whole idea of mysticism as an emerging spiritual trend as well. And it's interesting to see that a lot of the talks this weekend seem to be addressing issues of mysticism. I was quite struck by that. And certainly, when I actually tried to look at a kind of spirituality that might be evident in Douglas Coupland's novels, The closest thing I could find would be something that could be described as a mystical spirituality, a sense in which we are part of a larger world, a larger meaning universe in which there is meaning, but not a meaning that we can collapse into easy creeds or simple doctrines, but meaning that we encounter through our lived experience and particularly through our body. If you look at the end of all of Coupland's novels, there's usually some kind of physical experience that's kind of like a small moment of epiphany for the characters, a small moment of revelation for them. At the end of Generation X, the lead character's hugged by a group of learning disabled children, or at the end of Life After God, the narrator is suspended floating in naked in a freezing cold mountain stream, or at the end of Miss Wyoming, one of the lead characters talks about their experience of seeing a dust storm caught in sun and rain in the desert. Now, each of these are really small experiences, fragmentary experiences in these people's lives. But just at this moment, they're catching some kind of sense that they're part of a greater pattern. There's some kind of mystical experience. It's not fitted into any kind of neat theology or neat creed, but there's something experienced here, something mystical going on, in which people encounter meaning, encounter it, I think, very significantly through their bodies. And that kind of experience, it's a small one, but it's a fragment of hope for them to carry on and to live with some kind of meaning. Now, as you're listening to me talking about this kind of spirituality, particularly with mysticism, you might be thinking, well, and some people do write this, that this is just kind of sensation-based spirituality for people who want a quick buzz, who don't want the sort of hard work of learning about the Nicene Creed. I guess we can understand that. But who want some kind of quick fix spirituality that's going to give them a buzz, give them some kind of quick sense of meaning in life, but hasn't got any real depth or substance to it. And I think there could be some truth in that. But I'd also like to suggest that the kind of mystical spiritualities that are emerging do actually have some potential within them to be genuinely resistant, that a spirituality that's grounded in the body, not necessarily in terms of formal creeds, but in terms of valuing lived human experience, valuing the body, could be genuinely resistant, could be a genuinely inspirational spirituality for our times. And the kind of symbol I've got of this for you today, that going on to the second video clip, is from Toni Morrison's book Beloved, novel Beloved. And what I'm going to do is show you a little video clip and then read a little bit from the novel about a character called Baby Suggs, who's a preacher, an elderly black woman preacher, uneducated preacher, who preaches to a congregation of people, a black congregation in the forest. And this is set around the time of the end of slavery. Freedom from slavery hasn't quite happened yet. If we can have the second...
Waiting on her daddy to come.
Daddy!
Alec bought Baby Suggs his freedom, but slavery done already busted her legs, busted her back, hands, everything. When she come here, she ain't had nothing left to make no living with. Besides her heart. Baby Suggs used to preach right here.
Let the children come. Let your mothers hear you laugh. Let the grown men come. Let your wives and your children see you dance.
Toni Morrison carries on in the novel. She writes, "It started that way, laughing children, dancing men, crying women, and then it got mixed up. Women stopped crying and danced, men sat down and cried. Children danced, women laughed. Children cried until, exhausted and riven, all and each lay about the clearing, damp and gasping for breath. In the silence that followed, Baby Suggs, holy, offered up to them her great big heart. She did not tell them to go and clean up their lives or to go and sin no more. She did not tell them that they were the blessed of the earth, its inheriting meek, or its glory-bound pure. She told them that the only grace they could have was the grace they could imagine, that if they could not see it, they would not have it. Here, she said, in this here place, we flesh. Flesh that weeps, laughs, flesh that dances on bare feet in grass, love it hard. Yonder, they do not love your flesh, they despise it. They don't love your eyes, they'd just as soon pick them out. No more do they love the skin on your back, yonder they flay it. And oh, my people, they do not love your hands. Those they only use, tie, bind, chop off and leave empty. Love your hands, love them. Raise them up and kiss them, touch others with them, pat them together, stroke them on your face, because they don't love that either. You got to love it, you. And no, they ain't in love with your mouth. Yonder, out there, they will see it broken and break it again. What you say out of it, they will not heed. What you scream from it, they do not hear. What you put into it to nourish your body, they will snatch away and give you leavings instead. No, they don't love your mouth. You got to love it. This is flesh I'm talking about here. Flesh that needs to be loved. Feet that need to rest and to dance. Backs that need support. Shoulders that need arms. Strong arms, I'm telling you. And oh, my people out yonder, hear me. They do not love your neck, unnoosed and straight. So love your neck. Put a hand on it. Grace it. Stroke it and hold it up. And all your inside parts that they'd just as soon slop for hogs, you got to love them. The dark, dark liver, love it, love it. And the beat and beating heart, love that too. More than eyes or feet, more than lungs that have yet to draw free air, more than your life-holding womb or your life-giving private parts, hear me now, love your heart, for this is the prize. And saying no more, she stood up then and danced with her twisted hip the rest of what her heart had to say, while the others opened their mouths and gave her the music. Long notes held until the four-part harmony was perfect enough for their deeply loved flesh. Now, Baby Suggs, I think, is a very powerful example of how a spirituality that's grounded in the body, grounded in the love of the body, grounded in the love of human experience and an honouring of human experience, can actually be a spirituality that enlivens us, that gives us some kind of hope for resistance against that which diminishes people, that which oppresses people. Just finally, there were some... I'll abandon the OHP at this point. Three quick points I want to make about the future of the church in view of the kind of issues I've been looking at. One which might sound a slightly perverse thing to say is that I think there will be some growth for some churches in the near future, and this will be for churches which have a very rigid theology, a very rigid, often biblically based theology, and which market themselves on the basis of that set of ideas. Now, this is quite perverse in terms of what I've been saying so far, but I think this will be one of the areas in which we see church growth in the near future, because there is a market for certainty. Lancaster University are involved in doing a project looking at church growth and alternative spiritualities in the Lake District. And what they're finding is that the liberal churches are tending to get squeezed of members, but the conservative churches are tending to increase in members, because those kind of conservative faith communities are some of the few places where you can actually go now to get kind of conservative social beliefs reinforced. This certainly is my perception, but increasingly now, whenever the media wants a kind of conservative, slightly reactionary moral view on something, they often wheel out someone from the Evangelical Alliance now. And increasingly, churches with a very rigid, biblical-based, ethical, theological agenda are standing out as perhaps a beacon for people who want that kind of certainty, who want that kind of agenda. And so those churches may see some kind of growth in the near future. The downside is that I think what I'm talking about in terms of the Generation X search for meaning is the more mainstream trend in spirituality. So while those churches may, with their certainty, be experiencing some growth, they'll actually be becoming increasingly detached from mainstream society and mainstream culture. I mean, increasingly, I feel, have little to say to it. A second point is that I think the church, unless there's some kind of major social upheaval that we can't envisage at this stage something like the collapse of the capitalist economy. The church is going to remain a minority institution in Western culture. And because my long-term background was in charismatic circles, I got very used to the idea of the next big revival was just around the corner, and God was going to move powerfully, and you know, the whole of Britain was going to come under the sway of the Holy Spirit, and all the rest of it. But I think if we look at the kind of sociological evidence now, that seems very unlikely. It seems hard to see how that's actually going to happen. And I think what's increasingly important for the church now is to think constructively about what it means to be a minority institution and how it can perhaps be salt and light in this culture, rather than having expectations of becoming a mainstream sort of social institution again. And I don't think that's necessarily a negative message, because as a minority group within society, the church can still have tremendous influence. If the church can continue to invest its resources, continue to focus on becoming a prophetic community and a pastoral community, then it will be offering something tremendously important in a contemporary culture which I think is increasingly characterized by fragmented relationships, by loneliness, social isolation, by prejudice, and by social and economic injustice. If the church becomes some kind of beacon against those kind of ills in contemporary culture, it will offer something that whose importance far outweighs the kind of numerical membership of the church. So even though the kind of numerical decline may not get reversed, the significance of the church could still be very important in the future. I think one of the most inspirational things that I took part in recent years was when the G8 conference was up in Birmingham and taking part in the Jubilee campaign ring around the ICC, the convention centre then. 70,000 people came that day, the largest demonstration that Birmingham's ever seen, largely inspired by the Christian Church, taking a lead in cutting-edge social movements there, social campaigning. And I think if the church can take that role, it will have a key role to play in the future of society, regardless of how many members it actually has. Okay, you've been very good and very patient listening to me as I've gone on here. What I'd like to do is try and have more dialogue now. Is the other microphone switched on at all, do you know? Or should we try and do it just... It's a small room, isn't it? Should we just do it from the room? Okay, yeah, I'll do that. I'll try to come as far forward as it will. Okay.
What you've been talking about is clearly the fact that postmodernism is a very key influence in society today. I've tended to find that much preaching, certainly in conservative arm of the church, is still very much aimed at a modernist audience, and the assumption is that they understand religious concepts like salvation, which a lot of non-church people don't understand. How do we, as members of churches which are often quite modernist in their approach, do something which will enable us to make our churches more relevant to a postmodern generation? Sorry, that's a very long...
Yeah, no. So the question was, could you hear that at the back, actually, or not? No. So the question was about how can the church become... a lot of conservative churches still have quite modernist assumptions. How can the church preaching become more relevant in a postmodern culture? I think... I know this is a slightly grim thing to say for a church audience, but I think part of the process might be actually recognising the depth of, or the extent to which there are barriers in terms of traditional Christian theology actually being communicated to mainstream culture. That I think we are in a culture which, whilst it isn't formally atheist, doesn't think in traditional theistic terms. It doesn't think in terms of a God who's up there, who sort of has any kind of control over the world. Although surveys suggest that if you actually look at how people think, they tend not to think in those lines. But I think things that are much more experience-based, which might not be about necessarily, well, we'll look at this a bit in the kind of marketing the gospel thing, but things that can draw more on people's education. I think alternative worship is potentially a very good example of that, though I guess it's often a problem because alternative worship tends to be a reaction against that kind of evangelical approach sometimes. There can be a kind of lack of mission focus, which makes it hard to draw people in. But things like that, which are more experience-based, I think is tremendously important.
So I think certainly in my own church, there's a feeling that postmodernism is evil and modernism is good, but that's far too simplistic and it's quite hard to handle.
I think, yes. I think that's That's very difficult. I have to say at this stage, I'm not actually involved in any church at the moment, so I kind of sympathise from a distance with that and don't necessarily have a lot of answers. But I think addressing those issues are absolutely key. I don't know if anyone else has any thoughts on that, about how the church becomes more relevant to contemporary culture. Yeah, funnily enough, the literature which talks about Generation X as a this was an issue about whether Koopland's work actually translates into a UK context, whether it's more true of North America. The literature which tends to talk about Generation X as people of a certain age is American literature, and I think that doesn't work in this country at all. But Koopland's actually a Canadian writer rather than an American writer, and that makes a difference. I think Canadians sometimes have a slightly jaundiced view of Americans. And he is certainly himself very sceptical about a lot of the things that have been written about Generation X since he published the novel. So I think actually he's got a lot more useful things to say that actually translate into a British context much better than some of the American literature does. Sorry, at the back, yeah.
Sorry, I didn't hear it. I just wondered, I'm sorry that I missed some of your lectures.
Sure, go.
Somebody was telling me something about Generation Y, which is doing the next thing, and I just wanted to explain that a little bit more because it's only something I'm in the class, and I don't know how to prepare or...
Yeah, so... The question is there a kind of Generation Y and what's the significance of that? And basically, how they link together. If you think that there's a Generation X who are people of a certain age, then it makes sense that once those people run out, you have a Generation Y that follows them. Now, I'm actually quite sceptical that there's that first Generation X group in the first place. And I think people tend to assume that that's true. But I think if you try to make generalisations about people being the same across different generation or... being the same within the same generation. I've got close friends who are very conservative evangelicals, and I'm in no way fitting into that camp. There's actually very little in common that we have in terms of our attitude towards faith and the world. But we're actually the same age. But I think making generalisations based on the age that people are works quite well if you're wanting to try to market things to people. And a lot of the literature about Generation X is written by people in management and marketing and religion who want to try and market things to a particular group of people. But I don't think it actually holds up as reality. So the Generation Y stuff, I can't really help you about because I'm really sceptical that actually exists. So that's not that useful, is it, really? Sorry, that's a long no there, wasn't it, really? I've lost track of time. How are we doing for time? Quarter past. Yeah? It's the hearing, isn't it? It's the age, isn't it? It's terrible, isn't it? Any other comments? Yeah. And that seems a much more healthy kind of view of church and spirituality to be something that actually doesn't sort of take place just in a couple of hours on a Sunday morning, but that's actually more something that's a part of everyday life, that's a part of our everyday experience, and inspires that and inspires our relationship in some kind of authentic way. I think that's absolutely true. And I think, whilst not getting into sort of generational generalisations, I think people who've gone through the educational system in this country over the past sort of 20 years, one of the things that's been very much encouraged is critical thinking. And so to expect people to sit in churches and just be told kind of truth from the front and here's the truth and don't think too much about it is just hopeless. I mean, no wonder no one's going to engage with that, because we're not simply... And thank goodness that people are thinking critically. No, I think that's a really healthy trend. But I think the churches, in terms of their preaching and educational work, need to engage with that and think seriously about that.
about the idea of there being different ingredients, like the physical aspect. I wonder, let's say that I'm in a salsa dancing group, and it's a great physical experience, it's a great sense of community, our meaning in life is really just to enjoy ourselves and to support each other. What distinctives does the church have to offer from a group like that that has all those key ingredients?
So could there be a salsa spirituality? Not from my three lessons so far. I've not connected with it. But
what's different about the church in your perspective?
Yeah. Because one of the things I've not talked about today, but I have done research looking at clubbing spirit, the idea of a possible clubbing spirituality. And I think one of the things that the church has, and I find really inspirational about Greenbelt, that is very distinctive, is it focuses on social justice issues. Because I think in parts of club culture, there are some really positive things. The emphasis on community, on friendship, is actually a really healthy trend there. Perhaps on sort of more fluid views of sexuality, again, a very healthy move there within club culture. What there generally isn't, though, is a kind of wider social critique, a wider sort of sense of what social structures are going on. And I mean, if you just think about recreational drugs use, I mean, people boycott Nescafe because of Nestlé's unethical practices. People who are buying ecstasy are supporting financially people who are into much worse things than Nestle, but there's no kind of wider kind of economic political critique that's part of that culture. And I think that's something that the church does very much have to offer. There could be more as well, but I mean, I think that's one of the key things for me anyway. Yeah. Sorry, there was... Right, so a question there about perhaps some different trends, some people being into the sort of middle class thing of being into your jobs and your career, and another group who are not so much into that, who are more into searching, reading books like the Paulo Coelho books, like The Alchemist. Have other people found that at all? Does that ring true with... Yeah. So is there a sense that there's different attitudes to the search for meaning there? Some people are just playing it very safe. They're just going for a very safe sort of nice house, nice life kind of thing, and other people are searching more.
Yeah. I think people who search, they run the risk of making mistakes and going down the wrong way.
Right. And sometimes it can be, within traditional church circles, it can be hard to see that because there might be aspects of things like surfer culture or club culture that people will just react against. It's like the sort of Mr. Mackey drugs are bad thing, really, which whatever we think about that, there can be an immediate turn off from those cultures. But perhaps there's more of underlying spiritual life in those than sort of just owning a nice house in the suburbs and a nice car.
Following on from all those comments, one of the stereotypical middle-class Christians would set very stereotypical middle-class right-wing Christian ideas. And there was also a whole very large group of a kind of subculture from the town, of a kind of alternative goth-type people that were around at the time, that had all kind of become Christians en masse. One of them had, and a whole load of them followed. And they brought their very distinctive kind of alternative lifestyle ideas with them. And I was very pleased to see the church responding very well, because a lot of churches, they showed up wearing their distinctive clothing, and it would have freaked out a lot of people in very traditional churches and wouldn't have known how to deal with it. But it was really good to see that they were discipled very, very well, and they managed to integrate into a group of very, very different people. And I think we can be encouraged by that, in that I think we need to recognise that people come to the church from very, very, very different backgrounds. And we can't put together one package that will deal with all of them.
Mm.
We need to treat them as individuals and treat them in a way that will enable them to be part of the body effectively that works together.
Yeah.
It can be done, but I've seen some mistakes made, and we've got to be careful not to make those mistakes.
I absolutely agree with that. So is there someone down there? A hand waving, a hand over there. Am I hallucinating hands now? sorry, at the back. It's a really good question. I think it's a really complex question. I think one of the best writers on this for me at the moment is Zygmunt Bauman, who's a sociologist who wrote the book Liquid Modernity, and he's written a lot on modernity. And it's a bit hard sometimes, but I mean, if you want to have a bit of a grapple, then it's worth having a look at him. But one of the things that he would say is that what's distinctive about postmodernity, which I think feeds into the Generation X search for meaning, is that we are increasingly presented in contemporary culture with a wide array of lifestyle choices about how we can live, but not necessarily having a sense about how we can judge between them. And I think this kind of captures the Generation X sense of, I need to have some kind of story that makes sense of my life. But I'm presented with so many different options, and how do I choose between them? And I think that is a characteristic of postmodern or late modern culture, if we want to think in those terms, that perhaps people conceive of their options in life as being much more fluid now, that actually being a self actually becomes an ongoing project. We kind of write our own life stories in a way, and feel that the way in which we do that is really significant, but don't always know how to do that, and that's quite a tension. So I think there is something about contemporary culture which is distinctive with that. But Bauman puts that a bit better than I do. But he gets paid more as well, so that's all right. Time for one more question. Yeah. Yeah.
So just as a common thing, people don't understand the concept of salvation. And depending on whether or not you have an interest in wanting them to understand that, you find a way within language they use, concepts that they do use, examples, stories, pictures, illustrations from the life that they live. So explain that, it's a fairly basic point, but it's fairly obvious.
Right. Just the point that if we're actually going to engage with people in terms of some kind of religious and spiritual search, it has to be done on the basis of some kind of relationship that actually recognises where they're coming from, and that's, I mean, just very clearly the case.
Language works.
Absolutely, the kind of language we use. I think I mean, we can push that as well. I think that that then gets into a theological question about how radical we're actually prepared to be. That do we still come with certain preset theological ideas that we're just wanting to present in a more accessible way to people? Or are we actually prepared to potentially have our theological ideas transformed by the conversations that we have with people, to think that actually there could be something in this other person's experience that changes the way in which I see God? Now, to go down that path is a very long and somewhat risky and complex path to go down. But for me, that's a much more enlivening way of doing theology, if we're actually prepared to value human experience in that kind of way. I think we better stop now. I've got my watch now, you'll be glad to know, which says nearly 4:15, so I think we probably ought to stop. But thanks very much for your time and your attention and your feedback today. I'm heading down to the SPCK bookshop in a little bit, so if anyone wants to carry on conversation down there, I'll be down there and be pleased to do that. Okay, thanks a lot. Cheers.